first two arguments of the metaphysical position seek to show that space is a priori. To say that it's a priori is to say presuppose in our knowledge of objects is presupposed because, right? It's a condition of possibility, because in order to be aware of an object at all as outside and independent of us, we have to have it as somewhere in space, outside us, and further that we cannot gather up our notion of space from objects, in part because we can represent to ourselves space absent of objects, but we cannot represent to ourselves objects without space. Hence, space is both a condition for our awareness of things as outside us and a condition of those appearances themselves. The second two arguments of the metaphysical position contend that space is an intuition, a particular, a singular thing, a singular unbeing. It's an individual and not a concept. This is an argument, again, mainly directed against Leibniz, which, if it's true, will make us have to think a bit harder about how or in what way the transcendental aesthetic forms a critique of the Newtonian absolute view of space and time, which regards them as real existences, right? So, of course, the great debate in the 17th century, which I'll come back to, probably maybe next time about this guy, was the Leibniz-Clark debate, which is a Leibniz-Newton debate, about space and time. The Newtonian said that space and time are real, they are big containers, right? Everything exists in space and time, while Leibniz, as I've just been explaining, thinks that space and time are ideal, which is to say unreal. They are simply mistaken representations or confused perceptions, which when can be analyzed out into the predicates of independently existing monads. Since both the argument about a priori and the argument about intuition are really targeted against Leibniz, and the question is, you know, what is Kant's argument against Newton? Since in some ways his position is analogous to Newton's. My supervisor, W.H. Walsh, always said that the Critique of Pure Reason was written with both eyes on Newton. You should always think in the background of everything Kant says lies Newtonian physics and the presumption that, give or take, Kant thinks that's the right account of the physical world. So, space is an intuition. So the thesis that Kant's now going to examine is that the one-many relationship with respect to space should be one of whole and part rather than concept and its instances. Right? So you have two types of primitive one-many relationships. Right? You can have a single concept of red, which then refers to an indefinite many red things. That's one many. Or you can think of the one many as a whole, which then can be divided up into its parts that are within it. This way of thinking about it is not quite right, but we'll come to that. So Kant wants to say, no, the one-many relationship with respect to space is not concept and instances, but parts and wholes. Someone want to read three?
Space is not a discursive, or as we say, general concept of relations of things in general, but a pure intuition. For, in the first place, we can represent to ourselves only one space. And if we speak of diverse spaces, we mean thereby only parts of one and the same unique space. Secondly, these parts cannot perceive the one all-embracing space as being, as it were, constituents out of which it can be composed. On the contrary, they can be thought only as in it. Space is essentially one, the manifold in it, and therefore the general concept of spaces depends solely on the introduction of limitations. Hence it follows that an a priori and not an empirical intuition underlies all concepts of space. For kindred reasons, geometrical propositions that, for instance, in a triangle two sides together are greater than a third, can never be derived from the general concepts of line and triangle, but only from intuition. And this indeed a priori, with apodictic certainty.
Thank you. Let's not worry about geometry yet. Kant assumes, and it's an assumption that underlies everything he does here, that the concept intuition distinction is exhaustive. This is, of course, another aspect of his rigid form-matter distinction. And I've already suggested in week one that was a little bit worrying. How far he is committed to this absolute distinction between concept and intuition, we will have to see when we come to the schematism. That will be the payoff of worrying about that. But if anybody in here is in the Adorno course, you may say that everything in Adorno depends on simply denying the rigidity of the distinction between concept and intuition. Or, as Adorno would put it, between the rigid distinction between art and science. I'll leave that as just something to keep you sleepless tonight. Okay. With this in mind, Kant's strategy is to show that the relation of space to spaces is unlike the relation of a concept to its instances, either extensionally or intentionally. What's the extension of a concept, anyone?
All of the instances that fall into the concept.
Right. And what would be the intention of a concept?
The privileged entities that are supposed to fall under the concept?
Not exactly. What's the intention of a concept? What's the concept again for Kant?
Rule.
And a mark.
So,
the intention of a concept, you're using paradigm case, and that's not quite right. What he wants to be would say the easier to do with something bigger. The intention of Apple would be the marks that belong to the mark Apple. So that would be red, brown, fruit, etc., etc. Right? Its meaning. So you break it up into its meaning, you break up each of its meanings into smaller marks. So colors get saturation, whatever the features of colors are, and the like. Okay, he wants to suggest that space is different from either the extension or the intention of a concept. And above all, he wants to do so, he thinks, because he thinks we can only represent to ourselves one space. Now, why does he think that? Well, his thought is that to think of a space is to think of it in order to individuate a spatial region. Let's say that's what I mean by think of a space. In order to individuate a spatial region, what do I have to do? How do I kind of figure out the spatial region? Yeah, I locate it. I say, well, it's to the right of this one, to the left of that one, it's 60 centimeters below, and I can do that indefinitely. That is, for something to count as a space that I could be aware of, I have to locate it. But I have to locate it with respect to any possible other spaces that I know, roughly starting from here, where else would I start from, and that therefore I always think of space as a indeterminate, that's what goes wrong with this picture, it's an indeterminate horizon in which to think of any point is equally to think of it as, think of any region is just to think of it as enclosed by further regions. And then to think of those regions as to think of themselves as enclosed by, you know. And therefore we have a, and I'll put it this way, a pre-intuition of the totality of space as this one through which I can locate any other particular space. That is to say, where a space is simply to map it with respect to spaces that I know. And for this, and this is the second argument here, I've got to start with the pre-intuition of the one. So the thought is, look, when I think what's the wrong analogy here? The wrong analogy is that the relation of spaces to space is like the relation of bricks to house. The reason that's wrong is it's true. I build up my house from its parts. Right? So I add part to part to part and I get a house. I don't build up space that way. If I start with a pre-intuition of its wholeness, what I'm ever doing is simply eliminating it. I'm always simply drawing boundaries within this indefinite, unlimited whole. So that in a wholly unreflective, wholly non-conceptual way, I am always presupposing, right, this indefinite spatial totality, this one, of which particular spaces are a part. So that every part of space is simply considered as somewhere in relation to other spaces, and hence space as a whole is a pre-given, pre-intuitive. It's not, I mean, why am I using this word pre here? Because that's what you were wanting to know. Well, for the simple reason, I don't have an awareness of this big one. It's not that I actually have a concrete awareness of this big one of which it's all a part. Rather, the intelligibility of the spaces I am aware of are always thought on the model of being parts of this whole, which I construct out of the process of limitation. So that it's not that it's given to me like a representation is given to me. It's given to me as the underlying logic of my spatial forms of awareness.
Isn't that already presupposed in an intuition? So perhaps you wouldn't need to have an intuition?
No. There's my intuition. There's the watch. I intuit it. I don't pre-intuit it. I just get aware of it. But I'm saying, so the oneness is just my awareness of it. Right? But in the case of space as one, I'm not aware of it as one in the way I'm aware of the watch as one. I'm calling it pre-aware in the sense that I am simply supposing that if this is a space, then outside of it there's a further space of which this is a, etc. So I'm always doing the extension limitation business as part of my natural way of thinking about what it is to be aware of a region of space at all. That's the thought. Yeah.
Does this connect at all to the anticipations of perception? I can't remember what it's called. Later on in the book. In the sense that it's precisely that pre-intuitive moment that allows you to categorize certain kinds of things that then will be intuitive?
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. So that's right. So think of space as intuition as a anticipation is a nice word. Indeed, anticipation is a nice word for the a priori altogether. It's we anticipate space as operate the space in a certain way. So at A282, Kant says the concept of a cubic foot of space, wherever and however often I think of it, is in itself throughout one and the same. But two cubic feet are nevertheless distinguished in space by the mere difference of their locations. These locations are conditions of the intuition wherein the object of this concept is given. They do not, however, belong to the concept, but entirely to sensibility. So, I mean, now just thinking that a it would be very disappointing.
Although you wonder if it happened anymore. If someone said, I'm going to sell you this great 2,000 square foot lot. And you come in, and it's just a foot square. And you say, wait a minute, where are the other 2,000 square feet? Oh, they're all in the one square foot. That misses something about the meaning of space. Because it's a lot, because they're not spatially different, right? What makes them 2,000 square feet is they're external to one another and so on, indefinite. All right, here's a counterexample. This is a famous counterexample that comes from Tony Quinton. Do we have to represent space as one? Well, Quinton says, let's say I go home tonight, I get into bed, and I fall asleep, and the moment I fall asleep, I wake up in a tropical paradise. And I roam all over this tropical paradise, and there's just no way I can find New York. There's just nowhere. The only way I can get to New York is by going to sleep in the tropical paradise. And as soon as I go to sleep in the tropical paradise, I wake up and I'm in New York. Hence, we can conceive of two spatial regions that are themselves not spatially related to one another. Ergo, Kant's law. Are you convinced?
That tropical paradise is like this pink elephant. It's just in your mind.
Why do you say that? I get up, I eat food, it has an economy, it has certain problems, as tropical paradises often do. We get bored, especially on Sundays. You keep thinking, God, I wish there was a metropolitan around, and the only way to get there is we take our boats and we... Nowhere! We get in a jet plane. No! Just all that happens is just more goddamn tropical paradise. However, if I go to sleep around about 11, 12 in the evening, I wake up in New York and it's 8 in the morning.
Still, if you're in the... When Kant here discuss the epistemic knowledge, and when you see this beautiful boats and islands or some palms, beaches, then you must get in epistemic knowledge, you must still get an intuition. You must have intuition and
But Quinton's suggesting that. When I'm in tropical paradise, I happen to give philosophy courses, and I give this story about space as an intuition, and everyone thinks, yeah, it's an intuition, and it's closed in one. Of course, the tropical paradise feels like a spatial whole, too. It's just that I can also give courses, well, in New York, here I am. So this side we know is okay.
But you said it feels like. Also, you said yourself. You said it's just.
No, I'm letting Quinton suggest that this is not. If we're going to run with this example, we have to suggest that this is not an illusion or a fantasy or an hallucination or anything else. It just so happens that the only mechanism for getting from one to another, right, is deep sleep, and that's because, I have an emanation, and my emanation, is released at the moment I fall asleep here, and I wake up there. So you can have your whole Jungian psychology.
Epistemically,
the in order to conceive of space in each individual instance, either here or in tropical paradise, you can only conceive of one given space. So it's not that objectively there are two different spaces, but that in Kant speaking, like transcendentally, what are the preconditions for the possibility of understanding space? Within each individual instance, sleeping and waking, there is only one. Like, it's not divisible when you're in New York, it's not divisible when you're in the tropical island.
Well, that's right. So each of them, and this is what makes it a bit scary, each of them separately satisfies the Kantian requirements, just that there are two. Yeah?
Does the fact that they're never simultaneously happening have anything to do, have any relevance?
Well, I'm just taking that to be a mechanism. Just, you know, sometimes you get from one place to another by walking, sometimes by going to sleep. Yeah.
It seems to me that there's a somewhat shallow claim, which is that even if I don't know where New York is, I know that it is somewhere and that it belongs to the same conditions in which I intuit here as when I try to get there, and that it is somewhere. But then there's also, I think, a much more robust claim, which is that I bring my understanding or my representation of space that I've achieved in New York to me, to this, or with me to this island. And so I was thinking of an example, for instance, where there was an impossible squeeze between two trees recently when I was home on vacation, and I just took it, and they're like, well, what are you doing? And I realized, you know, like, well, that's about how big my kitchen is. So
you knew
these kind of spaces. Okay. And there's that kind of understanding that I think.
Okay. It turns out your first argument is more robust than your second. but the first argument seems to me terrific. And it's this. Kant's argument is epistemic. And his claim, therefore, would be that all the evidence for two-ness would be incomplete, since it would always remain a question where each space was with respect to the other one. That is, we presuppose that spatial questions have spatial answers, right? So the way in which, of course, the counterexample works is to make a spatial question where turn on a non-spatial mechanism, namely falling asleep. So it's where I am after I fall asleep in New York, or where I am after I fall asleep in the tropical island. And we would still want to know where it was spatially, even if we traveled indefinitely and could not find it. That is, Kant would say, and this is why I want to say the claim has, and this tells us something about the unity of space, that it has, as epistemic conditions do, normative force. Right? That in order for it to be intelligible to us, so Quinton's is logically intelligible, I want to claim, but not epistemically intelligible. And since the whole point of the Kantian exercise is to show that logic is not a sufficient constraint on possibility, then we do not care that it's logically possible that there are two different spaces. What we care about is whether we can know that there are two different spaces. And the only way we know of knowing that two spaces are different is if they're spatially external to one another. And that's simply constitutive of what it means to know that two spaces are that. So this gives you, and I hope, what it underlines is how epistemic Kant's notions are. He's always showing, and this is the trick for all Kantian idealism, so I'm going to beat this thought to death for 14 weeks. What makes any Kantian notion transcendentally ideal is that there is some feature of its intelligibility, that is how we think about it, that is connected to the possibility of knowledge. So when we think about space, we're thinking about outsidedness, independence of us, individuation, relation. That is, well, I'm not asking yet, so that almost everything I've said about space is really not about space in the way that, well, we haven't done any geometry yet. What we've been thinking about is the role space plays in our life. So what Kant means by transcendentally ideal is that there are features of these notions, space, time, substance, causality, self, that cannot be understood in purely empirical or metaphysical or ontological terms. That in order to get a grasp of them at all, you've got to think about the role they play in our representing the world to ourselves. And since what it is to have a world is to have a representation of a world, then the role they play in us having a world, which, since the role they play in us having a world is the worldhood of the world, then they are the existential determinations for the worldhood of the world. I say all that because I know there are Heideggerians around, and I just want to remind you that Heidegger in Being and Time, and only in Being and Time, I would argue, is a textbook Kantian. I think all the rest of Heidegger is something else, but in Being and Time, it's a Kantian exercise. Okay. So, the argument for space being one is finally an argument, and the parts being parts of this one, is finally an argument about the kind of role that space plays in our coming to awareness of these differences of things, which is, again, different places. The fourth argument in the metaphysics position covers much the same terrain as the third, with the addition of the notion of infinity. So he says space is represented as an infinite given magnitude. Now every concept must be thought as a representation which is contained in an infinite number of possible representations as their common character, and which therefore contains these under itself, that's this business here. But no concept as such can be thought as containing an infinite number of representations within itself. That is, I can get apple down to red and round and fruit, and I can get red as saturation and, you know, all the features of color, but at a certain point it comes to a halt. no intention of a concept is infinite. Otherwise, what? Meaning would be impossible. Meaning is not infinitely divisible. But space is infinitely divisible. It is in this latter way, however, that space is thought for all parts of space, coexist ad infinitum. Consequently, the original representation of space is an a priori intuition and not a concept. So, space is infinite in that the very idea of space is such that it presupposes both the divisibility of itself downward and it presupposes space outside it, which borders it and contains it. Right? And that was this argument. That I don't have the idea of space. I don't know about you, when I was a kid, as all kids do, you ask, where does space end? And almost every kid has the idea of a wall. Brick wall, concrete wall, and then you play the game. What's on the other side of the wall? That's Kant's argument. There's always another side to the wall. So that it's infinite, because it is part of the very meaning of our idea of space, that for every limitation you can extend it. Okay. So we have two sets of arguments. Space is a priori, presupposed in our awareness of objects, and it's an intuition. And it's a pure intuition. It's a one that is presupposed in our awareness of any spatial region. And we can kind of we probably want to make, I don't know how tired you are, but I want to make one more distinction. Can you bear one more distinction? Alright, one more distinction. Let's distinguish between form of intuition and form of intuition. And then next time we can talk about the transcendent ideality of space. In geometry, in incongruent counterparts. This is too hard. Let's talk about incongruent counterparts for 10 minutes. That's more fun. And it's directly related to the idea which is not mentioned in the critique. Does he mention it? Let me mention it, does he? It's in the Prolegomena. Not in the critique. But let me mention it. Kant, in three different places, discusses the problem of incongruent counterparts. And he uses arguments concerning incongruent counterparts in order to prove different things every time he mentions it. So in 1768, first of all, let me start. Do you all know what incongruent counterparts are? It's this, right and left. The thought is that the difference between my right hand and my left hand is that internally they are absolutely identical. Their difference is one's right and the other's left. And that looks like it's irreducible. Or in a two-dimensional world, You can do D and B will do it, or you can do P and Q, right? Okay. Now, the point here about, let's just do P and Q. Let's say it's a two-dimensional world. These two things, for the moment, assume are absolutely internally identical, namely the line, the size of the thing, the relationship between all the parts internally is exactly the same as one another. Yet if I take the cube, no matter what I do with it, I can never make it overlap with the P. The only way I can do it is if I lift it off the plane into another dimension and then fold it back on, which is cheating, right? So Kant thought this is astounding it is astounding because it means that, well, what does it mean? And he had three thoughts about what it might mean. He was really struck by this phenomenon and kept coming back to it his whole career. And he thought there was something deep here. And the first thing is in 1768, when he first thought about it, he thought that it meant that space is absolute and independent of its matter. That is, when he first thought about it, he thought this shows, at this point he was a Newtonian, he thought this shows that space cannot be reduced to the objects in it. Consider each of these a monad, right? Here you go, and you want the identity of indiscernibles. These are the identity of indiscernibles. They're perfectly identical. They should be the same, and yet they break Leibniz's law because they're different. And I don't mean merely now that they're in different places. I mean that one is right and one is left. And Kant thought that just showed that spatial relation could not be reduced to its content. In his inaugural dissertation of 1770, he used the same argument to show, and this is my favorite one, but I think it's true, that our knowledge of space is intuitive and not conceptual. Right. Who's going to be my victim? You're the victim. So tell me, what's the difference between right and left? How do I know the difference between right and left?
Well, I guess according to my position in space, it is something that would be, the difference between what's to the right of me.
No, this is absolutely right. Kant will eventually use the word orientation for this, that there isn't a way of discursively telling anyone what the difference between right and left is. It is your orientation in space. That is, right and left is irreducible to any conceptual knowledge. It is just a spatial orientation, and therefore, in the appropriate sense now, is intuitive. Right? I'm perfectly aware of right-handedness and left-handedness, although no conceptual discursive thinking can ever capture the difference. So the thought now is, and I actually think this argument works, it shows that our understanding of space cannot be gathered up in concepts. Eric was worried that I kept talking about the concept of space. But now I want to get this notion both of the pre-givenness of space, right, and now of orientation in space, right and left, neither of which... both of which are, let's call it, orientations rather than conceptual graspings. and cannot be cashed out in any conceptual terms. I'll let you think about this. There is entire literatures, indeed books on this topic, and what people do is then rotate it through various spaces. But what I want to say, since all the arguments against it turn on adding another dimension, so you move from from two to three dimensions, or three to four dimensions, and then you say the argument doesn't work. And what I want to say is, in any dimension of space, an object is that space either has incongruent counterparts or does not, and that therefore it works for kinds of space, say three-dimensional as opposed to four-dimensional spaces, but of course it gets defeated by the movement between spaces. But just take it that that's not an argument against it at all. That's what we call, at least where I come from, G. So I find the idea that right and left are primitive compelling. Which is to say, there is no possible world that we could know in which glove makers would only need to make one glove, or shoemakers make one kind of shoe. In 1783, in the critical period, Kant thought that the argument for incongruent counterparts could be used to show that space is ideal. And this seems to me his worst argument. I wish he hadn't said it. I actually, for years, tried to forge a text of the Prolegomena that would show that it was written by you. And I never was able to get away with it. It's a terrible argument. Anyway, how does the argument run? The argument runs, but it's worth going over it because it tells you something about Kant's thought and how his mind works, and how his mind works will be relevant to how we cash out what's deep and what's shallow in him. His argument runs, things that are qualitatively identical, internally alike, must be interchangeable. Some spatial figures which are internally alike are not interchangeable. Therefore, if we assume that the some things that are, if we assume that the identity of indiscernibles holds for things in themselves, then it follows that we know appearances only and not things in themselves. Jill Berkhauer, who wrote a book dealing with a lot of this stuff, runs the argument this way. Incongruent counterparts are different in virtue of their differing relations to space as a whole. That's right and left, right? Step two, all relations among things in themselves are reducible to non-relational characters of the relata. So let's define a thing in themselves as things that have only monadic predicates. Okay? Therefore, if space and figures within it are things in themselves, then P and Q must be identical. But in fact, P and Q are not identical. Therefore, space and the figures in it are not things in themselves. Therefore, space and the things that are in it are ideal. That's the argument of the Prolegomena. What do you think of them? See, you're all happy with incongruent counterparts. You're thinking, oh, maybe Kant said something that was true. And then I use a simple little argument to kind of do something with it and get all nervous. Well, the thing to think about here is that Kant is presupposing here a definition of things in themselves. Namely, a thing in itself is a thing independent of all external relations, which is to say, a thing in itself is or would be, if there were such, or if there are such, a Leibnizian monad. Now, this is a bad way of thinking about things in themselves, and a bad way of thinking about the ideality of space and time, but you need to be aware that it is one of Kant's constant temptations. That, as I'll say more about next week, he meant three or four different things by transcendental ideal. That there isn't one idea in his mind. He actually had three or four different things, and he was pretty uninterested, as I'll say more about, in the differences, which are very important to us. But one of the things in his heart of hearts, I think when Kant, went to bed at night, but what do I really believe? I think he was secretly a Leibnizian. I think he secretly loved the thought that the world is composed of nothing but little spirits. And that he just thought that even if that's the metaphysical truth about the world, we can't know it, we can't even hypothesize about it, we've got to think about the world in a very different way. But, so to speak, I think he thought if there were a God's eye view, that is, if there is a God, and he saw the world, what he would see is not what you and I see, that's our fallen human way of seeing the world, but he would see nothing but an infinite number of monads. Now, of course, there is a... That's a bad thought. There's an interesting, but I think equally false, metaphysical thought behind it, the one I mentioned earlier. Namely, objects have in themselves only monadic predicates, and all relational predicates are mind-dependent. That will get you pretty much the same result. But even that would be a sorry way, I think, to think about what's deep about transcendental idealism. So at least for the moment, we will pretend that the last 7 minutes never existed. We will simply put them, let's be Heideggerian, put them under erasure. Instead of putting being under erasure, we're going to put Kant's monadic sympathies under erasure. And next week, we'll see what deeper thoughts about transcendental ideology can be gotten from the metaphysical exposition, and we'll put the arguments from geometry, etc., etc.